the little man.
All right, welcome back to the Malloy Program. Brad Friedman and Brad Blogg in for Malloy all week. We're going to move from naked governor to, oh, man, naked prisoners at Guantanamo. Sorry. Joining me now and taking your calls at 877-520-1150. If you have any questions about what the hell's going on down at Guantanamo, this is the guy who literally wrote the book on Guantanamo. Andy Worthington joins me. He is the freelance journalist and historian and a regular contributor to the UK's Guardian, the Daily Star Lebanon, the Huffington Post, antiwar.com, Counterpunch, and Alternate. He's also the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 759 detainees in America's illegal prison. And he's staying up very late for us tonight. We're doing a little sleep deprivation on him. How are you, Andy? Welcome to the show.
That's very good, Brad. It is a bit like sleep deprivation. It's very late here, but I'm all right.
And I really appreciate you staying up late for me tonight, because really, you are the guy, you are the source. When I have a question about Guantanamo, when there's a story breaking on Guantanamo, you've got the scoop. You've got the real details. For example, on this Alibi fellow who was found reportedly committed suicide a few weeks ago. He was the link that the Bush administration offered between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, and that link came under torture. We're going to talk about him in a little bit and about that suicide. But first, the title of your book, Andy, The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 759 detainees in America's illegal prison. Illegal prison? What's so illegal about it?
Well, you know, there's only really two ways that you put somebody in captivity. One is that they're a prisoner of war and they're treated according to the Geneva Conventions. And the other is that you hold them as a criminal suspect and put them forward for a trial. The Bush administration came up with a third way, enemy combatants who could be held without charge or trial if that's what the administration desired. And if they wanted, they could put them forward for special military trials, special terror courts, the military commissions. You know, and that's the mess that we're all left with. Mess is actually the word that Barack Obama used in a speech a couple of months ago to describe his frustration with what he was dealing with. But that's it, really. I mean, there is no third way in which you deal with prisoners.
And it's not the prison itself, then, is not illegal. It is what is going on and the way they're operating it. Would that be more accurate way to describe it?
Well, I'm not sure that it's ever been, you know, really cleared up as to you know, why it is where it is and what that means. I mean, it was specifically chosen cynically by the administration because they thought that the U.S. courts wouldn't be able to have any oversight of Guantanamo because technically it belongs to Cuba, even though the U.S. Holds sovereignty over it, or, you know, is in charge of it. And in fact, you know, they got away with that for 2.5 years until the Supreme Court said, look, you're holding these guys without any rights whatsoever. You've never screened them properly. We actually are going to say to you that that the U.S. law does apply there. And because you have held them without any rights whatsoever, we're going to do something quite unusual for prisoners in wartime. We're going to give them habeas corpus rights, and we want them to come to courts and be able to explain why you're holding them. And of course, that was the summer of 2004. That was 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. It took another 4 years for the Supreme Court to have to come back and say the same thing again, because in the meantime, politicians were prevailed upon to change the law and to deprive them of these rights.
And there was really no cleanup between the time that Supreme Court decision was made and the time Barack Obama came in. I mean, my understanding is he just walked into the mess you described. It was an absolute mess. Records were missing for these folks. They were all over the place. What records there were? Is that an accurate description of what he found when he took over in January?
I think that is an accurate description, yeah, and I think it's kind of still the problem, and I think that they've to some extent, have tried to find these kind of elusive extra bits of evidence. You know, they came across the files and they looked at them and went, "What is that? It?" and the truth is that in most cases, that's it.
Hang on, hold the thought, Andy. I got to get to a break here. We're going to come back with plenty more with Andy Worthington and your calls 877-520-1150. Brad Friedman in from Malloy. Stay with us. Welcome back. Friedman in for Malloy. You're listening to the Malloy program. Malloy's on vacation. I'm not. Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com. Speaking with Andy Worthington, a journalist and historian and the author of The Guantanamo Files, the story of 759 detainees in America's illegal prisons. You can give us a call, 877-520-1150, 877-520-1150. And there we go. I got it back. Andy, who joins us, by the way, from, are you in London? Am I right?
Hi, I'm in London. Yes.
Actually, in London, in the middle of the night. God bless you, sir. We were talking about Barack Obama and the mess he inherited when he walked in, and I've got some criticism for him, but before I get to that criticism, the files we had, how many hundreds of prisoners were there when he took over, when Obama took over in January?
There were 240-something.
And most of them had already been released. Am I correct? Is the majority of folks who were released, I'm sorry, the majority of folks who were captured turned out to be completely innocent and they were released?
Yeah, they were either completely innocent. I mean, that's the case with hundreds of men. Or in the case of hundreds of other men, they had gone to Afghanistan long before the 9/11 attacks to help the Taliban fight their enemies in Afghanistan in an inter-Muslim civil war, the Northern Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, as soon as 9/11 happened and after that the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan, then they instantly became enemies of the United States. But for the most part, these guys hadn't gone out to fight the United States. They'd gone out to fight Afghans, other Muslims.
And so this whole worst of the worst business, these guys are the worst of the worst. Turns out most of them weren't worst at all. Some of them had nothing to do with terrorism whatsoever. And when Obama came in then, they found that what? The files were all over the place. The information about these guys was it just messy, or did it not exist? Were we holding people that we just had no information on at all?
Well, I don't think there's a lot of information on a lot of the guys, actually, Brad, to be honest. I mean, you know, the majority of the information has come from the interrogations of other prisoners. Well, we know that, you know, if torture wasn't used, then other forms of coercion were used. We know that there are certain prisoners who have been bribed to provide information, you know, better conditions, who've gone for that. People with mental health issues have been coming up with stories against other prisoners. This doesn't really count as evidence. I think a big problem has been that it's been extremely difficult to get information from certain intelligence agencies. But, you know, again, part of this problem is, do they really have anything or not? So, yeah, I mean, a terrible mess in a way that he took over. But I think that they've dithered a lot and that they really should have had enough background information to say, well, look, most of these guys don't need to be here. You know, this was a colossal mistake on the part of the previous administration. And I think they haven't made that clear enough.
No, they haven't. And the Democrats have sadly fallen for so much of this. Oh, we don't want to, we can't give the money to close down Gitmo because, my God, these terrible, these worst of the worst, they'll come into the United States and somehow they will escape while they're being transported. I mean, we keep already the worst of the worst, the real worst of the worst in our Supermax prisons. And this notion that we're unable to, you know, keep these guys locked up is laughable, not to mention, hey, some of them are innocent and some of them, sorry, but they may have to be freed even if they do pose a danger. And many of them, am I correct to presume here that many of them may not have posed a danger before, but after being held without charges for 6, 7, 8 years, maybe they're a little ticked off right now at the U.S. and maybe they do pose a danger that we created?
Well, I think that may be the case. You know, there may be some of the people who are held who've been, you know, radicalized by what's happened to them. It's not my experience from looking at the stories of the majority of the people who've been released from Guantanamo. You know, I don't think that it's very easy to kind of create a terrorist out of nowhere, if you like. You know, I think what we really need to get down to is that there's, you know, there's a few dozen, maybe three dozen, genuinely dangerous people in Guantanamo, and the rest we should be looking at how to get rid of, how to send them home or find another place for them. Now, the dangerous guys that we're talking about, and I agree with you, you know, what's so scary about a country that has the most efficient maximum security prison set up in the world? Why are these guys somehow exceptional? They're not. You know, they've been held safely for 7 years in Guantanamo. They were transported there without any problem. Take them to the mainland, sort out the trials they're going to have. End of story. Let's get this horrible, long-running saga to an end.
I concur. Let me take a quick call, and then I want to ask you about Al Libby. Tim, calling in from Detroit. Hey, Tim, welcome to the Malloy Show. How are you, sir?
Pretty well. I think Mr. Worthington answered my question, but I'll still ask it. In his research that he's done on the Guantanamo detainees, has he found that probably the ones held now are most of them innocent of any sorts of acts of, as we define it, terrorism?
Well, you know, I don't know what the exact figures are, you know, but I would say that there's a few dozen people there that are dangerous enough to be put on trial. You know, I mean, we know that they include people who have claimed involvement in the 9/11 attacks and various other terror attacks, and there are some other people. But all the figures that have come out over the years, I mean, recently Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff, said that, you know, all the information that he'd been presented with when he was in a position to be hearing about this were that there were no more than two dozen prisoners there who had any serious intelligence value. And over the years, stories that have come out from CIA operatives and from various people inside the administration who've spoken about it have mentioned these same kind of figures, two dozen to three dozen people who are significant in any way and in any way connected to terrorism.
Does that answer your question, too?
Could I have a follow-up question?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, regarding even those who are suspected of any terrorist acts or crimes, due to the torture that they've undoubtedly received, wouldn't any evidence now in any new trials be considered a fruit of the poisonous tree?
Well, yes, in theory, I think that's absolutely right, and I would very, very much hope that in future there won't be cases where somebody's got to be put on trial and these kind of things will arise. But, you know, my way of looking at it is, if there is genuine evidence against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed that he was the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, I can't see that there's a jury anywhere in the United States that's actually going to care when it comes down to it in a courtroom what happened to him. They are going to convict him. You know, this is how I think it will work.
Sounds like vigilante justice, actually. But
sorry, what's that?
That sounds like vigilante justice, American style.
Well, I don't think so. I think that if genuine evidence can be provided, evidence that wasn't obtained through torture, then, you know, then sadly everybody will reach the conclusion that they're going to overlook the other things that happened to them. I can't see that people will be released. Because that happened if they genuinely were involved in these terrorist attacks.
Thanks for your call, Tim. On the issue of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, how certain are you that the information we've obtained from him was not under torture is actually accurate? Because I know, you know, a lot of the 9/11 truth folks out there, they don't buy into this KSM thing at all. Where do you fall on this? Do we have good information, or did this all come under torture?
Well, I mean, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib bragged about their involvement in the 9/11 attacks to an Al Jazeera reporter before they were captured by U.S. forces. You know, it seems to me that on that basis, really everything that happened afterwards was you know, extremely counterproductive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you follow the story of Ramzi Youssef, who's the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and the whole involvement in the attacks on the Twin Towers in 1993 that Youssef did, the plans to blow up airplanes, the plans to use airplanes as bombs, I think there's a long story of that, and that probably makes sense. You know, I mean, I hesitate to prejudge absolutely, because I think even after everything that's happened, this should be sorted out in a courtroom if at all possible. But, you know, I would say that that's the case. It looks that way. But, you know, we're talking about a handful of people, and, you know, out of nearly 800 who were held in Guantanamo, and out of the many thousands who've been held elsewhere.
We're speaking with Andy Worthington, author of the Guantanamo Files. I almost called it the Gitmo Files, close enough. The story of the 759 detainees in America's illegal prison. When it comes to putting these guys on trial, guys like KSM and so forth, which Obama has said, essentially, given three options. One, these guys are going to be released because they're innocent, like the Uyghurs we saw recently released. They're going to be put on trial in a courtroom, or they're going to be given, well, actually, there's four options. They're going to be given a military tribunal, or in some cases, held indefinitely without charges. Essentially, when the government can't make his case, is the government here, including Barack Obama, not trying to have it all ways? In other words, if they can't get a conviction, then they're not going to put him on trial of any sort.
Well, they are trying to have it every way possible, it seems, yeah. And, you know, I've got a problem, really, that they've moved a guy who they say was involved in the African embassy bombings in 1998 to New York, where he's facing a trial. Now, they've said that they might not do the same with some of the other guys, maybe the ones involved in 9/11. Now, that's obviously caution on their part, where they think, either because of the torture that took place, or because there are some fears that they have about not securing a conviction, then they're not going to go ahead. Well, I don't think that it's really legitimate to have two systems, one which is the established federal court system, and the other which is the military commissions, which were revived by Dick Cheney and have had a terrible and inglorious history for 7 years, mm-hmm. With only three dubious results, and you know, almost every time that they convened, they were a mockery. But if they were to go ahead, they would undoubtedly be full of holes again, would be caught up in all kinds of problems that haven't yet been foreseen.
Do you have any confidence then in Obama's plan as far as the changes he's making to these military tribunals? Are they going to have any better results, or are we going to be forced once again to just leave these guys to rot for years on end?
Well, I still think they won't be fair. I mean, you know, I just do think that it would make much more sense to just say, look, we're going to get this down to the smallest number of genuinely dangerous people. We're going to go for the court trials. As I say, I mean, I honestly think any genuine evidence is produced, there's no way a U.S. jury is going to let these guys go. The other thing, though, that you mentioned, which is preventive detention, which, as far as I see the way it's been proposed, is that this wouldn't apply to these highest value prisoners. It would apply to people that they suspect of militancy, presumably the kind of militancy that tends to terrorism. So actually, slightly lesser characters in this whole scene. These must be the guys at the fringes of the numbers I've been talking about, maybe the third of the dozen of these prisoners. You know, they obviously think there are more than that because they've been bandying around figures of between 50 and 100. Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, if these guys aren't really considered that dangerous, why are we making exceptions for them that say, you know, you're either guilty or you're innocent as a result of a court case? We're inventing a new category of prisoner who we can hold. And, we start with suspected terrorists. Who do we go on to next? You know, we have in your country, you've lived for over 200 years with the laws as they stand, that if you suspect somebody of something, you put them on trial. If the trial fails for whatever reason, well, then that guy goes free. That's how it works.
Yeah.
You know, it honestly terrifies me, the thinking of inventing a new category of holding people and doing it humanely and according to the law and reviewing it. It's like, no, I don't think you've kind of got this, really.
Yeah, and
if you haven't got a case, sorry, you know.
I know, and I'm afraid that that's what they're going to do. That's what Dick Cheney and George Bush did, and it seems to me that Obama is doubling down on that idea that we can do that. We're speaking with Andy Worthington, author of The Guantanamo Files. We're going to take your calls when we come back, 877-520-1150. Don't use Mike Malloy's normal number. He ain't going to get it. 877-520-1150 if you have any questions. And we're going to find out what came of Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, if I pronounce that right, right after this. Brad, in for Malloy. Mm-hmm. London calling. That's for you, Andy. Staying up late in the middle of the night for us out there in London. Andy Worthington, journalist, historian, author of The Guantanamo Files. Much appreciated, sir. I want to get, we got a bunch of calls here. So, very quickly, on this story of Ibn al-Sheikh Alibi, and am I pronouncing it close to correctly there, by the way?
I think that sounds about right to me, actually.
Thank you. For a Yankee, not bad. So he's one of these guys who, one of these ghost detainees, suddenly he kind of goes missing after 2006, right?
Yeah.
And shows up, he shows up a week before he then turns up dead in a Libyan prison, and a supposed suicide. Now, he was the guy who, under torture, supposedly, provided the link between Iraq and Al Qaeda, the link that was completely phony, didn't exist after he'd been essentially buried alive in a box for 12 hours or something and told them anything they wanted to know. Bush Cheney used that then when they wanted to go to war. Was he the only guy that they had, the only information that they had, phony information as it was, that tied Iraq to Al Qaeda at the time?
It was the main one. I mean, I heard more recently that they pushed Abu Zubaydah for similar information as well. And on both bases, I think it was kind of rather stupid. I mean, there's a veteran FBI agent who said, Alibi ran an Afghan training camp. Why the hell would he know anything about Iraq? And this is one of the guys who had Alibi and had started talking to Alibi and was getting Alibi to cooperate without torturing him for that short period of time, a couple of weeks, I think, before the CIA put him in the box and sent him to Egypt. These FBI guys, not only were they skilled in interrogation, but I think they knew exactly what they were looking at. And the story was really built up that the training camp that Alibi and Zubaydah were involved in was connected to Al Qaeda, whereas in fact it wasn't.
And is there any more information? He was supposedly, it was a suicide. Do we have any information to confirm or deny that? Very quickly, too, because I want to get to calls and we're almost out of time.
Sure. Well, I mean, the Libyan insiders say that, this is a regular occurrence with Gaddafi, that people commit suicide when it's found out, when the bodies are delivered, that, they've miraculously shot themselves in the back of the head. It doesn't seem likely at all. The timing of it is weird. Human Rights Watch researchers had been to the prison just before he died, so maybe the Libyan government thought he was getting a bit too close. But I must admit, I was suspicious because the U.S. flag was raised in the embassy in Tripoli for the first time in over 30 years, just a few days after he died. It all seemed a bit convenient.
For what reason was the U.S. flag raised?
Oh, well, to really solidify the bonds of friendship between both countries, closer than ever.
Just out of the blue, they raised this flag?
Yeah, 3 days after Alibi died.
Wow, that's bizarre. Milton, Florida, Dan, you're on the Mike Malloy Show very quickly for Andy Worthington. Oh, Dan in Florida?
Yes, this is Dan. How are you doing tonight?
Good. What's up?
Okay, basically, I just have to disagree with you a little bit on, it's with both Bush and Obama. We're kind of, I think, mixing up concept of operations and implementation here. We're talking, you're on a battlefield and, people are dying left and right, your side and their side. You have people left over, you take them as prisoner. On the battlefield, you have to take people. Where would you suggest that we take them?
Okay, where would you suggest? Thanks for that call, Dan.
I got more.
I know, but we're running out of... Actually, Andy, can you stay over the top of the hour? I know it's a god-awful hour out there, but I got some good calls. I'd love you to stick around, if you can stick around for 15 more minutes.
No, I can do that. I mean, may I answer this question?
Yeah, please do. Go ahead.
The key element is that, I'm not saying by any means that war isn't a difficult business when it's being fought and that all kinds of problems arise and what do you do with prisoners. The key thing that I think people need to understand that didn't happen, specifically on the instructions of Cheney and others high up in the chain of command, was that every war since Vietnam, the U.S. military had held what are called competent tribunals. They take place very close to the place and time of capture of prisoners.
Andy, I got to take a hard break. Stick around. More Andy Worthington after the top of the hour. You're listening to The Mike Malloy Show. right, welcome back to the Molloy Program. Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, your friendly citizen investigative journalist, in for Molloy. Coming up very shortly, Ed Asner is going to be joining us. Ed Asner, you may know him as Lou Grant. He's going to be joining us and taking your calls. He's also the star of the hit new Pixar film, Up, which rocks. Up with which it rocks. I kept Andy Worthington, journalist and historian, author of Guantanamo Files, stories of 759 detainees in America's illegal prison, kept him over a little bit longer because there was some calls. I want to try to clear out the calls here that we have on this issue. And Andy, thanks for staying up until the 3 a.m. or whatever the heck it is out there in London. Our last caller, we were you wanted to finish your answer to that last caller. I got to put him on, don't I? There we go. I'm the fill-in host. Yeah, that sort of thing happens. Sorry about that, Andy. So, yeah, we wanted to finish your response to that last caller about the court system that we've created here.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say that you know, in the battlefield situation, what had happened since Vietnam onwards was that competent tribunals, part of the Geneva Conventions, were held, where they would decide whether the people that they captured were actually soldiers or whether it was people who'd been caught up in the kind of fog of war. And the kind of crucial statistic to me was that in the first Gulf War, they held 1,200 of these, and nearly 900 of the men were sent home because they'd got the wrong people. Now, the military was preparing to do this in Afghanistan, and the orders came from on high. There are no battlefield tribunals, no competent tribunals. We're not having them, essentially because Cheney and Addington, who were kind of driving the thing, had decided that everybody that they caught was an enemy combatant, that they didn't need any screening.
Really? So nobody was filtered out?
Remember this. Hey?
So nobody was filtered out? Essentially, anybody that they caught, they kept them and they shipped them into prisons?
Yeah, they sent the orders.
Wow.
From on high. Every Arab that came into U.S. custody had to go to Guantanamo.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man. All right. David in Los Altos, California. Welcome to the Molloy Program.
Hi. Thank you. Andy, I think my question might dovetail with the last one with the answer. I remember there was a lot said when we started putting prisoners in Guantanamo that these were not prisoners of war. They were the enemy combatants. Is it too late to just call them prisoners of war? It seems to me the war is with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. We don't have a ceasefire. We could just continue to hold those prisoners.
Good question, David. So, yeah, we have we used enemy combatants before, or did we make that up entirely for this new war?
Yeah, no, that was made up. I mean, you know, it's an interesting point about prisoners of war, and in theory, maybe it isn't too late, but then we would have to have a different conversation. The specific conflict that these men were captured in was the overthrow of the Taliban. Now, you know, Karzai has been the president of Afghanistan for over 4 years now. When does the war end? This war on terror has been going on longer than the Second World War. Can it really go on forever? I mean, they've said it will last for generations. According to the Geneva Conventions, you can hold people to the end of hostilities. But if they really are prisoners of war, then we're now going to get a load of lawyers saying, and I, understandably, I think, when does this war actually end?
Yep. And so legally, there are legal reasons that we cannot call them prisoners of war at this time, right?
Well, they didn't start off as prisoners of war. I mean, it's such a mess that in certain ways they're actually being treated partly as prisoners of war. I mean, that's partly because the courts demanded that the Geneva Conventions applied. But in other ways, they're treated as criminal suspects. And in other ways, they're still really this kind of non-person in between all these categories, which is these poor guys who are enemy combatants who can effectively be held forever without charge or trial. So.
how lovely. Boy, America is great. We can do anything. Armin in Beaver Braden, Florida, real quickly for Andy Worthington.
Andy.
Hello.
I think it's obvious, not only in my opinion, but I think probably if you were even more open than you're being, that how could you not conclude that these prisoners, they're buying time, the United States is buying time, primarily the Bush crime syndicate and Cheney crime syndicate, because the last thing that they want, and I watched this reaction through all the media, is when they first announced they were going to bring them, outside of the fact, the fear factor of the people in general, it's been programmed that any of the people over there are out to get us for the last 15 years since Gulf War One. The fact is that they were jumping all around. The military came on, the media, all these different things. It's obvious to me, in my opinion, that these people that are being held down there, they're buying time because the last thing that they want to do, the people, the PNAC crowd, Project for New American Century, is they the last thing that they want, it would finish the knot on incriminating Bush and Cheney in a conspiracy against the United States of America. And what it is,
Armin, we're short on time. Can you phrase that in the form of a question?
Okay. Well,
thank you.
They don't want them in court.
What's that?
They don't want them in court because they'll spill the CIA special ops in the Mideast and how they were infiltrated. I believe they were infiltrated, and they were totally trained by the CIA to be terrorists, and they were manipulated. And
all right,
they don't want the whole story out because then the American people will know what's really going on with these oil company lobbyists like Bush.
All right. Okay. Armin, thanks. I'm sorry. We're short on time. Thanks for that thought. Any response on that, Andy?
Well, you know, I mean, there is a story of how, you know, the training camps that were established in Afghanistan were established during the Soviet occupation when the United States was funding the Mujahideen. So, I mean, there is you know, clearly a line from what went from American funding to people who became the enemy. But, I mean, I think the bigger issue about why Cheney wanted to stay open and why so many politicians wanted to stay open is that they can sustain the illusion of a war on terror, so long as they're not really made answerable. I mean, that's particularly why they don't want it dismantled and they don't want cases to go to court, I'm sure.
And is that why Barack Obama doesn't want to dismantle this thing, or is he trying to dismantle it as best as he can?
I think he is trying to dismantle it. I just think that he's not been as thorough as he should, to put it mildly.
Okay.
He's wavered. He's putting too many options on the table. But I think he means it.
All right. Real quick, last call here for you, Andy. Eric in Huntington Beach. Did I hit the right one? Yeah, Eric, you have a question for Andy Worthington.
Yeah, real quick,
yeah,
Brad.
Thanks.
And Mr. Worthington, is we have a long and storied history of military tribunals here in the United States that goes back to our Revolutionary War. There's things from the Civil War, like Posse Comitatus, Ex Parte Milligan, which is a Supreme Court case precedence. It was ex parte because Lincoln was dead, I believe. There's also case law, and this goes all the way back from 1957, Reed versus Covert, that the U.S. Supreme Court reheard a case from 1956. It was a woman, service personnel's wife in England, who was prosecuted within a military tribunal. The Supreme Court went all the way back to the Magna Carta. Thank you, England. Thank you, our ancestors there in England and the U.K. And made it very clear that the military, which is the executive branch, Article II branch of government, is not supposed to have competing court system with our Article III judiciary, period.
Okay, thanks for that, Eric. Thoughts, Andy?
Well, it's very difficult to see what's the clearest route forward. I mean, I know that there is a history of military tribunals. I just, my feeling is that what's happened with these over the last 7 years since they were kind of revived by Cheney is that they're discredited in the eyes of, if not America, then in the eyes of the rest of the world. And I worry that by trying to tinker with them and reintroduce them, it will, whatever their pedigree might be, it's a kind of license for trying to introduce a system that won't have universal approval. And what's really needed after the Bush years is for these things to be dealt with in a way that around the world people are going to regard it as legitimate.
Yeah, we've created a real damn mess here. I think no matter who came in, we've just got a mess on our hands. because of these idiots, George Bush and Dick Cheney, just to put it bluntly. Andy Worthington, I really appreciate you staying up way late for us. Please check out Andy's work. You can see his blog over at andyworthington.co.uk. Please consider buying his book. You can do it over there. You can check the link at bradblog.com. And the story that we didn't get to, time to, many of them, but really a heartbreaking story about this Mohammed El-Gharani, who was Guantanamo's youngest prisoner, captured at 14 years old, held for 7 years, finally released last week. Have we heard, did he arrive safely in Chad, Andy, real quick?
He did. They kept him in custody in Chad for a week, and then I think when his lawyers started making a fuss, they actually finally sent him home to be reunited with his family. Yeah.
About damn time. Thanks for being one of the few people who are willing to pay attention to these stories and to tell these important stories. Andy Worthington, really appreciate it. Thanks for everything. Go to bed, sir.
Thank you very much, Brett.
All right, cheers, my friend. We'll talk soon. Okay, we're coming back with Ed Asner. Yeah, Mr. Grant. We made him stay up late, held him over for 15 minutes. We'll make it up to him. He's a good guy. Coming back with Ed Asner and your calls, 877-520-1150, if you have any questions for Mr. Grant. I'm Brad. Back after this. I'll get mine.